Wilderness and Ocean Policy to order on March the 13th, 2007. I would like to welcome everyone here this afternoon. And first on our first, we're going to change the agenda just a bit. First, we're going to hear from Dr. Holly Easton, which it is our pleasure today to have her here and to have made the effort to drive to the Capitol this afternoon to share with us what she has learned and observed in Katrina in her work in New Orleans. Then we're going to go to a public hearing and possible work session on SJR 6, and then we will go to House Bill 2371, which changes the order just a bit, if that conveniences anyone in the audience to happen to know how that's going to go. And Dr. Easton, welcome. Come up to the table and share with us. If you'll introduce yourself for the public record, please.
My name is Holly Easton, and I am a family practice physician. I practice in Southern Oregon. And what I have given you today in the form of documentation, the form I will be going from is an outline, and it's an overview of my experience going down with the Red Cross and, in fact, working for the health department in Region 6 of Louisiana after the Katrina hurricane. There are a few documents labeled A, B, C, and D that my outline does refer to, and they are to supplement the discussion. I went down September 7th and returned September 23rd. My husband and I found out about the disaster watching CNN. And in this case, the news media appeared to be very helpful in that they were putting out phone numbers and lists of services that they needed people to come down and do. So,
Dr. Easton, just in case no one knows, Dr. Easton is the wife of Dr. Alan Bates. So please continue.
Yes, thank you.
And Senator Alan Bates.
And Alan and I also are partners in practice. We both do family medicine. So we tossed around how we could contribute to the relief efforts, either sending money, perhaps bringing up a family, and concluded that since we were both physicians and were in a space where one of us could actually leave, oftentimes it is difficult for a physician to leave their practice because they don't have coverage for their patients. Since we were married, it worked out. We decided that that would be the best effort we could put forward, and I went down as I had done emergency medicine most recently. I started contacting relief agencies because common sense told me it wasn't wise to get in the car and drive. I started with the American Red Cross. There is the Medical Reserve Corps and the International Medical Reserve Corps, and then the health departments in the Gulf states. Some of these I was able to get through to immediately on the phone, New Red Cross being one of them. The others, it took almost a day and a half of calling to get through. Once I registered as a board-certified physician who was able to travel with these groups, the Red Cross got back to me most quickly. That was in 2 days, I believe. And so I went and got crash course disaster relief training with the Red Cross. They usually have classes that are drawn out over a long time period, but because of the nature of this disaster, they had volunteers coming in, and they gave us a day worth of education and got us some base knowledge on how they did relief. It then took 2 days before I flew out. The Red Cross did arrange my travel. I had to go with them. And I landed in Baton Rouge, where there was a Red Cross representative that was gathering up all the volunteers coming in from all over the country. And we rented a car together and then went to the intake center, which was a closed-down Walmart in Baton Rouge. So a huge empty facility. We arrived there late at night. There was lots of activity, of course, lights on in the whole place, and we were allowed to get a cot and just find a place to get some rest before the morning intake. When the morning came, all the volunteers went through processing to be registered with the Red Cross as relief volunteers, and there were only two of us that morning that were physicians. The two of us that were doctors were immediately transferred over to work for the health department because the Red Cross does not do medical care. I went down with the Red Cross as a physician knowing that under their banner I could not practice medicine. They feed and shelter. My assumption was, and turned out correctly, so there was so much need in the area, I anticipated that there would be an opportunity for me to use my skills. And if there wasn't, I would be sweeping floors and serving meals, but I was good and respectful of that. The health department representative came over and said, you no longer work for the Red Cross, you work for us, and transported us to the Jerry Falwell Center, which was in fact a very large compound in Baton Rouge, and it was where the medical response and EMS, or emergency medical systems response, had been set up. The ambulance crews that had come in from all over the country were parked there and housed and fed there. The director for the state's health department was Dr. Erin Brewer, and she was stationed there. I met with Dr. Brewer and was registered with the state as an out-of-state physician. This required my driver's license and my medical license, which I had taken with me, of course, and I filled out paperwork for them. Once I got there and was meeting with Dr. Brewer, it became very evident that communication was a challenge. Cell phones were not up and running. The government people had BlackBerries and were using those. Some landlines did work. We were advised as physicians that our jobs could be pretty much whatever we wanted to do. There was so much need. And so I opted, instead of going down to the front lines where they were still going house to house and there was a lot of action going on, because I still am kind of a small person, and I felt there was more risk in taking that approach, to go up to Alexandria, which is the capital of the state, and work for the director of the health department there in Region 6. And Region 6 is the middle of the state and goes from the east to west border. It's the whole middle of the state. I needed a ride up there and was waiting on an ambulance crew, in fact, to transport me. So while I was doing that, I was asked to set up a crash medical clinic for the EMS responders, as the Jerry Falwell Center was their base. So they were driving down with their ambulances, doing their first line response of 12 or 18 hour shifts and coming back. And they had supplies, medical bandages and stuff, and medicines that had come into the center, but no clinic set up. So I was able to get that done in about half a day and see to a couple of the responders. The complaints I treated were skin abrasions and lacerations, respiratory illnesses, and some serious mental health issues because of the trauma they were witnessing and the shifts they were pulling, which were incredibly long. I rode over then to Alexandria that night and got to the health department and met Dr. John Naponik. He was the director for Region 6 and still is. Well, we spent the night on the floor of the health department, and him and his wife, who's also a physician, had been sleeping there for 10 days. He couldn't leave the health department. The next morning, I was partnered up with an Air Force Public Health Service physician, Dr. and Captain David Padilla, and our job was to be extensions for Dr. Naponik, basically. He was actually unable to leave the health department. He had so much he was running and so much he was trying to mount and organize. We communicated with the major players that were down there as far as volunteers went, and this was the American Red Cross, other entities that had put up shelters for the refugees, the public health service doctors, Medical Reserve Corps didn't show up, medical volunteers from out of state. We did have a significant group that participated and was very helpful from Indiana, local medical clinics and hospitals, and the refugees, of course. First and foremost, we were attempting to set up and deliver medical care. Period. A lot of these people had nothing, as you all know, and had been out of their homes and plopped down in a new location. We had to try to get nurses and doctors out to their location and then also to try to get them to clinics where we could get them in hospitals. The staff I had to pull from to get staff out to these shelters consisted of public health service physicians and nurses. They were kept for our special needs shelter, which was the one shelter where we had our high needs patients, that is people who were very sick. Between being in the hospital, well, and being in the special needs shelter, they couldn't have been placed anywhere else, and they could very well have been in the hospital. The other volunteers I had were just the group from Indiana, and Dr. Padilla and myself ran clinics certainly then too. We were able to get the bus system running to do routes to our major shelters. It took about a week, and this was with huge help from the American Red Cross staff. So we were able to get some routes set up, and that was just getting implemented as I was getting ready to leave. We also were trying to get medicines to the residents. The goodwill of the American people had sent a ton of drugs to Louisiana, and it went to the Red Cross primarily. And the Red Cross told me time and time again, we don't want this stuff. We don't want a pharmacy. We don't do this kind of work. We feed and shelter. So they were very uncomfortable having this huge stock of anything from Band-Aids and splints and catheters and IVs to medicines, including controlled substances. They had set them up in a locked room, of course, and Dr. Padilla and I were the only ones who took these out to shelters when we were running clinics. Otherwise, we wrote prescriptions for patients, and the challenge in that was getting them to pharmacies.
For where they?
Yes. A lot of the refugees had cars. Some had money to put gas in their cars. Some didn't. Some had cars that were sitting in parking lots. Rural Louisiana is not an easy place to navigate either. And we had shelters that were not just in Alexandria. They were in these little towns out in the country on these back roads. So though these talking Tinas everyone has in their car these days, you know, would have been great, but nobody had them then. So it was a huge challenge for us to even get people from point A to point B if they had a car with gas in it. The birth control issue, as far as delivering comprehensive medical care went, I think we did well. There was one aspect of primary care that we were unable to deliver, and it was a surprise to me, and it was birth control. I was able to give depo shots to refugees, and I was able to write birth control pill prescriptions. And I was advised that some of my physicians were writing Viagra prescriptions. The challenge was because we were thinking very much about outbreaks of communicable disease. We were addressing vaccination. We were addressing diarrhea and respiratory illnesses, but sexually transmitted infections, too, are that category of illness. And the only prevention for those is condoms. I was unable to deliver condoms to the shelters. And the paper that's labeled D does detail that a bit more. This is a proposal I put together when I returned from Louisiana, and I addressed it to Planned Parenthood Federation of America because I was at that time and still am on the board of directors for Planned Parenthood of Southern Oregon. This proposal is about setting up mobile units specifically to address contraceptive needs for shelter residents and could be just as well directed to your local health department. They could do the service just as well. At the time, Planned Parenthood just seemed like a good fit. It was just one area that we were not able to serve the population well in, and I have regrets about. Direction of medical staff was very necessary. We had a wide range of providers in these shelters. Sometimes I had doctors, and some of the doctors were camped out at the shelters, so they were there at night. Sometimes I had nurses, sometimes medical assistants, sometimes pharmacists, sometimes social workers. And so Dr. Padilla and I physically went to each of the shelters, and I created for them a triage instruction sheet, and that's attached as document A. And it's just a general direction for whomever the staff person is. If a patient or a refugee has this complaint, they need to be put to this facility. Is this something that needs to go to the hospital? You call the police, you call an ambulance, or can you manage this in American Red Cross facility, or do they need to go to our special needs shelter? So this was a document I then got out to all of the shelter staff, and it included some contact phone numbers because, quite honestly, they didn't even have those, all the shelters. Dr. Padilla and I gave presentations, and he had put together a lecture, and it is document D. We would go out and talk to the shelter residents. He would give them this document, but the questions were primarily about infectious disease, vaccinations they should get, and one of our shelters had a large population of Ninth Ward refugees, and some of them had actually gotten back to their houses and said to us, so, you know, everything we have is there, and we want to take some of it with us. There's pink mold, and it's this long, and it's coming from my ceiling. Is that dangerous to us? We didn't know. We didn't know what this stuff was. We didn't have information on the molds and fungus stuff that was growing in people's homes. They asked about their food supplies. Can I take what was in the fridge or go back in? And, of course, the answer on that was no. There was a lot of rumor, which you heard on TV, about outbreaks and mandatory vaccinations, and that just wasn't the case. So we were able to get some good education across, I think, with these lectures regarding that. Dr. Badia had put together for Dr. Naponic a summary of the shelters, and that's document C. It gives you an estimated census, and quite honestly, it was a surprise to me that the census was a guesstimate. The shelter residents didn't hold still. They were in and out. They set up campsites on the floor of a basketball arena. Some of our shelters had actually small houses and campgrounds, and this was one of the larger ones, the Pentecostal campground one. It was very difficult to get an accurate head count. We then, and on the back page of this, proposed medical coverage, and we were already up and running and doing it, but we put it on paper at that point. Every morning began at the health department with Dr. Naponic a conference call, and this conference call was between Dr. Aaron Brewer and all of the regional health department directors and their staff. We sat in on this and then got our new assignment for the day, which consisted of the aforementioned things. In summary, in my experience, what I saw as the weaknesses in the system and the relief efforts were that there appeared to be a very poor infrastructure for health care there in the first place. The communication between disaster relief entities was very hit and miss. On the first page of this, when I mentioned the Red Cross and the Public Health Service and the volunteer groups and the local hospitals and clinics, we tried to get everybody at the same table just one time and couldn't do it. Dr. Padilla and I were mobile every day and went out and met with the Red Cross and met with health clinics and doctors and hospitals. In fact, the CEO of one of the hospitals ended up putting us up and letting us live in his house for part of the time we were there. But we couldn't get everybody to meet at once, and that was hugely frustrating. I think we could have really benefited from having some face-to-face merging of the minds and not reinventing the wheel. The physicians, there were some physicians, and this is not a personal experience for me, but I did hear about this from my contacts in Louisiana, who went down and provided critical care services and triage. Critical care means like ICU patients who are in very bad shape, perhaps terminal, on ventilators, etc. And apparently some of these doctors had been after the hurricane charged, apparently with homicide. And I don't know if that has been settled or not. The medical response teams who we supposedly had available to us weren't there to a large extent, showed up late, or were short of staff. The Medical Reserve Corps was apparently standing at the ready, but didn't come to the area. I was there for 16 days, and they never showed up. I have met with and listened to a lecture, actually, from one of their officers in Bend last year, and he pointed out to us geographically where they were, and he had two or three teams, but they didn't come in. I don't know what they were doing, I'm sure something, but they weren't available to us as a resource. The Public Health Service showed late. They got there after I did, so maybe 10 days after the hurricane, and we didn't get many Public Health Service docs, so that's why we put them to our special needs shelter. I would have loved to have had Public Health Service staff to put out to these other shelters. The travel was challenging. Cars were without gas. People didn't have money to put gas in them. There was a shortage of rental cars for volunteers who had flown in from out of state. The population was very vulnerable to infectious disease outbreak, natural or man-made. We were very, very lucky and very fortunate this went as well as it did as far as infectious disease goes. The strengths that were so very evident were the quality of character and the work put in by the people who were down there. They were remarkable people. The people who lived there, the refugees, the volunteers, the local health department and medical providers were absolutely remarkable people. And it seemed to work very well to have the health department set up as a central command structure for delivering the medical care. That seemed to be a pretty good organizational plan. Thank you very much for your attention. Do you have any questions?
Dr. Easton, when you refer to the health department, are you talking about Rapides Parish or one of the parish's health centers?
Madam Chair, in fact, it was a regional health department. I believe there are either six or eight regions.
Okay.
Instead of counties, we've got these the regions, and so there was one health department director for each region.
I'm not familiar with that. A parish is a county, okay. The same, you know, dynamics or demographics, but I presume that that was four, maybe four parishes. You were actually looking at around 2,000 people, and they had all been brought from New Orleans to Alexandria?
Yes, they were all displaced.
And how did they get them there? Alexandria is not around the corner from New Orleans.
Yeah. A lot of them had cars and had driven up and made it that far. I don't know other than that how they got there.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Dr. Easton, both for your selflessness in going and also sharing the experience with us. The part of your story that I want to drill in on is the credentialing piece of it and the liability and the ascertaining of your credentials. From the story that you told, it didn't seem as though anybody actually checked to make sure that you were a physician until you arrived in New Orleans.
The Red Cross ID.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes. The next question, what reassurances were given to you operating in another jurisdiction about liability?
Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, it was loose. We were told we were covered.
Okay.
I got no piece of paper, and I didn't ask for one.
I'm unaware of what the regulations are in Oregon, but it seems to me that with respect to inviting other physicians into our jurisdiction, providing them with some tangible evidence of liability coverage, and recognizing that reciprocity, I don't know how difficult it is to move from your credentialing jurisdiction to another jurisdiction and take your license with you. And I don't know, Madam Chair, whether or not that was something that the committee worked on during the interim, but certainly to make it easy for medical providers, whether they're physicians or they're NAs, to make sure that they can move easily and have some liability protection.
And Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, it was an issue for one of the doctors I had who came down from Indiana. And he had gotten all the way down there and said, I really need a piece of paper that shows me I'm covered regarding malpractice. And we were working on getting that for him, but it was not readily available.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. It was very interesting. I think to me, and I guess I'm just asking for your agreement, This was a very challenging time to be working, and certainly we need to learn the lessons from it. One of the things that pleased me when I came to be part of this discussion is that public health is now part of our emergency preparedness discussion. I think that's a weakness that we've had in our system for a long time, that we weren't pulling public health into the discussion of virtually any natural disaster as frequently as we should. And I think that affords us the opportunity to address the liability issues and that sort of thing. So I guess I'm just asking you to affirm for me that if we can continue as we progress through the emergency preparedness planning and always keep public health as a critical component of it, then with our local providers within county health departments, we could bolster that structure that would allow us to then bring in additional emergency responders as needed and hopefully give us a better structure than you found. Would you say that's fair?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Cohen. Public Health Service they got it now. I was at the national conference in November, and the subject to a large extent was Katrina relief efforts. And what has been taken away to a large extent by people all over the country, health providers all over the country, was that the infrastructure being weak to begin with cost hugely, the relief efforts. So when we work on strengthening our primary care and public health care system, then we have a population that is stronger and much more viable. So when you have a disaster of any sort, you're starting from a much better baseline.
Thank you for bringing us that awareness. I appreciate it.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Easton, I just think this is awesome that you did this. And since I've been here with Dr. Bates so long, I guess I wouldn't doubt that that's in the blood of this family. And we appreciate him also. I'm just curious, hearing, you know, how you traveled and got there and everything, and because I'm trying to perceive if this state's divided into regions, has somebody prior to your getting there already surveyed, you know, the damage? Do they know how many to expect coming in? You know, meals, life-saving equipment, oxygen, dialysis. I mean, had that been done prior?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, no. I got the impression the state wasn't ready for it in that way. Region 6 was, as Madam Chair pointed out, fairly north. It's in the middle of the state. So physically, it wasn't damaged by the storm, but a large portion of the population had been moved up there. I don't think they had any numbers that they had anticipated. And so that was a large part of what we were trying to do, was quantify what the size of the population was we were trying to serve so we could ask for the right amount of resources. The local hospitals were very good. We didn't have anybody turn us down and say they were too full. The local doctors got exhausted, and that's part of why there was such a push to bring in outside relief. But I don't believe there were a lot of numbers, and people thought we're going to have 2,000 people. We were still finding out how many shelters there were when I got there. Shelters had just sprung up. Mm-hmm. Neighborhoods, and we were trying to consolidate them as quickly as we could so we could serve them well.
Follow up. I think this is wonderful that you took the time to give us all of this material. Also, I want you to know that. And I'm just curious, so none of the military was in your area to help, or life flight helicopters, or mm-hmm. to bring these people in? Or
we did, Madam Chair and Representative Nelson. We did have the National Guard with us. Part of the time I was sleeping at, there's a closed Air Force base, and I forget the name of it. Yes, and we were at that Air Force base, and the National Guard was there with us, but more of a security detail than doing medical care. The population had already been migrated up, and they were at the shelters. So now any transfer was between a shelter and the hospital, mm-hmm. or a shelter and the special needs shelter. Mm-hmm. It wasn't coming from New Orleans at that point.
Just one other quick follow-up. I'm just curious. Deliver any babies?
No.
That whole thing is just seems got, like that could
got close, but
really be a challenge.
Gynecologist met her at the hospital.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Shelton.
Thank you. Yeah, I get great health care during the session. The antibiotics are working great, Doctor. But, it's more of a comment than it is anything else. And one thing that really jumps out at me here is, and God bless the individual from Indiana for funding these people to come down and help out, but I think someone providing, voluntarily providing a treasure to fund people to come down and provide health care in a disaster, making a moral judgment on what kind of treatment or contraceptive prescription drugs or condoms can be provided, that really bothers me. And it's more of a comment than anything else. Imagine, if we're going to allow that, then what other moral judgments can we make? That really bothers me, being the husband of a brilliant medical professional and being the father of a brilliant young girl who will be able to make her own medical decisions just like her mother does now. Really rubs me the wrong way, Doctor. But I want to thank you for all your efforts. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative.
Senator Marcet.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Dr. Houston. We've had several in-depth reports from various physicians who went to the hurricane site during the interim, and the question I ask at that point is, are you recording any of this information for posterity? In 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, what are we going to look back on to help us remember what to do? And so I think this is great, but I'm trying to think of what kind of record keeping, what kind of anecdotal information, what kind of really important preparatory information that we could put into our files at the Department of Emergency Management so Ken Murphy can make that part of his archives. Because I think this is very, very important, and as time moves on, we tend to forget about it. It's still very fresh in people's minds. So that's something that I think is important to do.
And Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, one of the big documents that came out and came very quickly out was from the VA, and it was with medical guidelines specifically in response to the hurricane, and it's this thick. And so that is one, I think, very helpful document that people should have access to. I've got a copy of it, and I'm sure we could go to the VA and get more. I would believe that the health departments involved in the state of Louisiana will have written records of the challenges they faced, the deficits they found, and how they addressed them.
Well, can I follow up?
Sure, follow up.
I think the perspective from people from Oregon who went there with a plan and saw the chaos and worked very hard to overcome it, I think that's an outside. Okay, the VA may have their perspective. I think we need to have a perspective from people who were there, and a lot of it can be anecdotal, which would be very, very valuable, mm-hmm. and what we need to do to prepare.
Madam Chair and Senator Moore said, it seems that exactly what you all are doing and getting testimony from people who did go down there is certainly a step in the right direction, because we have, most of us, some sort of written documentation. For example, my proposal to Planned Parenthood PPFA regarding mobile units for contraceptive access, something as simple as that, and the papers we put together for the health department when we were down there. This stuff you take and you put it in place in Oregon as it's appropriate to this region, and then I think you will have gotten the knowledge that came from that experience.
Okay. May I just one more thing? Okay, and either the Public Health Department or the Department of Emergency Management should be the custodian of this information, I think, and just keep it on hand, have it. It kind of scares me when there's a document that thick, but I think that we need to have this on hand, because this the big one won't happen for 30, 40, 50, 100 years. I mean, we're talking a tsunami that can destroy half the coast and the valley and so on. That's one type of disaster. The other one is whether or not someone puts, God forbid, something in a container in the port of Portland or some other places, and we have a man-made disaster that we could happen anytime. So there are just so many things that we have to be on guard for and be prepared for.
Other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, Dr. Hawley, were these medications free for these people? I mean, these prescriptions, I'm guessing if they were evacuated very quickly, they probably didn't have a lot of cash handy. And
yes, yes. And Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, the samples, and there were a whole lot of samples, were free, yes. But I didn't have typically a bottle of a beta blocker or an ACE inhibitor or a blood pressure medicine to give someone that would last them a month. I didn't have that kind of supply. I had more bridge stuff like Band-Aids or wound dressing or catheters or a short course of antibiotics. And then the health department had put in place, they have something akin to OHP, and it's a different three-letter acronym. I'm sorry, I don't recall it. It's in these papers. People who were registered with that program were given, it was made evident to all the pharmacies to serve them quickly, well, and with the least amount of hassle possible. People who weren't registered, though, with that program was another story, and that was more of a challenge. The health department, as I recall, advised the pharmacies to give the discounted pricing to that population. But when it came to, for example, birth control, and I was looking at getting someone into a provider, and it would be as if they qualified for an Oregon health plan, there was a 6 to 8 week wait. The health department for Region 6, where I was stationed, served, as you all pointed out, multiple parishes. The director of this health department had 4 nurse practitioners to serve the middle of the state. They were fairly tight on staff, and that was their baseline.
Dr. Easton, I need to say to the audience that's sitting behind you that you not only went into a crisis, you went into a new culture. And I, being a native Louisianian and having been to college not too far from Alexandria, Natchitoches, Louisiana, I'm sure that it was a whole new world to you besides being thrown into a crisis kind of situation. And I'm just wondering, in closing now, as the time, I'd love for you to stay for 2 hours, but time doesn't permit us to do that. But I'm just wondering, what did you take away from this life experience?
Madam Chair, it is very easy to come to the realization that the quality of the people was the largest asset this whole endeavor had. And the locals, the Southern hospitality, I couldn't even get Alan to feel sorry for me because I was eating so well. We ended up staying, you know, in people's homes and being fed wonderful restaurant-type meals. And the quality of character, the refugees weren't complainers. We had to really work on getting them to complain to us about mental health issues. They were strong, solid, fairly stoic individuals. And it was an amazing and heartening experience to get to see that part of humanity.
I'm very happy to hear that, and I did not prompt her at all. I did not know what she was going to say.
Uh-huh.
But I am very happy to hear that, and I wouldn't have expected anything different, but I am very glad that you were met with warm hospitality and greatly appreciated for the time that you spent in Alexandria. And again, our warmest thanks to you for your service, but also for your long drive this afternoon to come and to share with us. And as Representative Nelson so thoughtfully pointed out, the good handouts, because that will help us as we are able to take time and read through those and use them to our advantage. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be appropriate if the audience in the panel stood and gave her a standing ovation for her outstanding
effort? I think that if they would like to stand up and give her an ovation, her husband can lead the crowd.
Happened like that before.
Well, everybody doesn't have Representative Nelson on their committee. All right, I'm going to move now to SJR 6. And Jim, I'm going to ask you if you will give us a report from the work group that met.
Yes, ma'am. The work group was formed at the direction of the committee. We met on February 16th. Representative Nelson was the chair, Senator Gary George, Representative Krieger, Representative Boquist, Representative Cowan, Ken Murphy were in attendance. After the result of the committee meeting, I was directed to submit amendments to LC for this bill. The first one was to allow members who are not physically able to attend a meeting or the legislative assembly that they be able to communicate, be part of the quorum, and be allowed to vote through electronic means, which would be cell phone, satellite phone, or some other form of electronic communication. The second item that the group wanted me to address in an amendment would be to set up the spending priority that the governor would first spend a rainy day fund or emergency fund. And I submitted those requests to LC. During the last several weeks, I've also submitted, at the request of various committee members, amendments that would address the issue of pandemic illness, which has now been replaced with public health emergency. Additionally, in the bill, I think it's on page 1, it talks about the governor convening the legislative assembly once a catastrophic disaster has been proclaimed. It now reads to immediately convene so that they would come in that much sooner. I have talked to individually to all members of the committee regarding the amendments. There are still some issues that are on the table that need to be discussed. The issue of the governor spending a rainy day fund or emergency fund first has not been resolved yet, and we have Joan Bobbitson here to help respond to those questions.
All right, very much. Joan, would you come to the table? We do not have anybody signed up, so we will have the committee discuss. I'm going to ask Senator Larry George if he might not talk a little bit about some of his concerns while you're there, Joan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joan, you and I discussed this a little bit a few minutes ago, but if I could, the portion of SJR 6 that has me concerned is primarily Section 3, that in essence what we do is we allow the governor to call the legislature in, but due to the catastrophic event, we we have a minority quorum. And then if you read down to subsection 4, as I understand reading the bill, you have a majority of the members who are able to attend the session. So you have basically a plurality of members passing legislation. And I know in other states they have a mechanism that when the governor calls you into a special session, you are limited to discuss only those issues that you're called in for. And I guess what I'd say, if we're going to allow the governor to have the power to call folks in where we have a minority quorum, and then a plurality to pass bills, that to ensure that it's focused, that somehow if you're called in under SJR 6, that the topics upon which you can discuss are limited to the catastrophic event. So you don't have people coming in under the idea of a catastrophic event and then being able to pass whatever bills they couldn't pass during a legislative session that a majority of the members wouldn't go along with. And so what I want to do is maybe put some sideboards in so that a minority of the legislature, once they got here, didn't start going well beyond the scope of the catastrophic event. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Joan Robinson from Legislative Council. As Senator George points out, the Oregon Constitution does not authorize the governor or the legislature to limit the topics for a special session. Once a special session is called, it can do whatever it wants to do. I mean, the legislature can do whatever it wants to do. The governor can say, I'm calling you for this purpose, but the legislature can ignore that. I mean, once you get here. I haven't thought about whether you could, I mean, obviously you could put something in SJR 6 that said under these circumstances, a special session, the governor would call a special session that would have to be limited to particular topics. The issue that would arise and the difficulty that arises with many of the provisions of SJR 6 is a catastrophic disaster can happen at any time in the biennium, and if it happens, for example, when the regular session is already underway, but you guys are on an in-district day and only half of you can get back, then it wouldn't be a special session, it would be the regular session. I think there are probably ways of dealing with that issue. I'm not sure what they are. After we talked, I went through the resolution again, and there are a number of places where it's specific in sections 3 and 4 that specifically say, that specifically refer to, for example, legislative assembly decides enactment of the bill is necessary to provide an adequate response to the catastrophic disaster. I could certainly go through and put that. I didn't put it in the purely procedural parts, but I could. I think I could say, for example, in subsection 4 of section 3, notwithstanding section 25 of article 4, which is the one that requires the majority to pass bills except for bills for raising revenue, I could say a majority who are able to attend shall be necessary to pass every bill or joint resolution that is necessary to provide an adequate response to the catastrophic disaster. I'd probably be able to write it a little better than that if I thought for a little while. So it would narrow it down in every section or subsection instead of trying to do it in a general way by saying in a session that is responding to a catastrophic disaster, that's all they can do, because I really don't know if I could deal with the issue of right now the governor can't call a special session when you're in regular session, and you can't call yourselves into a special session when you're in regular session. And that's because, as you point out, there's no point in doing that. You're already here and you can do whatever you want to do.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair.
And
all I'm trying to get at is that I don't want, we're really granting an immense amount of power to a minority of the legislature. And it's a huge amount of power that we're giving them to pass bills without a constitutional quorum or a constitutional majority here, or a majority here, period. And I just want to make sure that if we're going to grant that kind of sweeping power, that they don't, once they get here and they're in the building and there's a minority of people here and it's just a majority of the people who show up, that they don't then just start running off passing stuff that are completely unrelated to the catastrophe. Anything that can wait should wait until a majority comes back in. And that's what I'm trying to get at. I don't want there to be shenanigans going on in the building here. Yeah, exactly. and that's what I'm trying to get. If there's some way to narrow that into sideboard, so if you're under the clause of this minority, the plurality and the minority quorum, if you're under that clause, that only relates to things that have to do with catastrophe, that you can't use a catastrophe as a way to pass things with a minority of the legislature and with a minority quorum, or a plurality of the legislature and a minority quorum.
I would like to think, members of the committee, that under those circumstances, that any of us who are left alive would be so motivated to do the very best thing that we can do. But I think in the light of day, if we can get to committee members' comfort level, as I expressed to Senator George, I'm more than willing to do that. On page 3, line 3, Joan, is where you have it varied to state agencies for the purpose of responding. That's another place to a catastrophic disaster. So I don't think it's a real major thing. Whether it's the special session or the regular session, I don't know exactly how you can handle that. I guess all I would say is that, as I've expressed to Senator George, I'm very eager to go on and move these major pieces of legislation out as soon as we can that directly affect a disaster, in the event we're not in the process of doing things like this while there's a disaster. And I would feel really embarrassed for all of us if we're still dickering around with something that we did last year, and we had a major disaster and were unable to, well, as you just heard Dr. Easton say, the weakness in the structure, and they should have been doing that in Louisiana, and here we are. Senator Marcet?
Well, thank you, but I don't want us to rush to something that is not well thought out. Now, what happens after the session, after the special session, if things are still in disarray? I mean, life goes on. There's no assurance that the people who are not there at the beginning will be there at the next session. So at some point, the legislature is going to have to continue to do the work of the people in a variety of issues. So I understand what you're saying, and I agree, because almost everything is going to be related to the disaster. But once you get by that, there may be another special session. So we're talking, if we can separate the initial special session from the next special session that might have to be called to pick up where that one left off, that will have to deal with the bigger picture. So that would be my only, well, my main concern.
Would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, if I could. I think what I'm getting at is that if we have a, let's just say, for instance, there's only 12 of us that get to show up, and it's the Senate Republican Caucus, we'll make it 11. The Senate Republican Caucus is the ones that get to show up. You have a very different result than you had this week. We just have a different view, and it depends on who shows up. And the idea behind the process is that we don't want a minority of the legislature to start making policy outside of the catastrophic event just because they're called into the circumstance. And that's what I'm trying to get at,
yeah,
is that I just don't want to be in a situation where, I mean, I'm sorry, if you're in this building and you're fine and there's a catastrophic event someplace else and you've got the group of people you need to pass a piece of legislation you've been trying to pass for a while, you're going to pass it. That's what's going to happen in this building. I don't care if it's, you know, in the, how long in the future. We can think the best of all of us who are legislators, but the fact is we need to make sure we put those sideboards in, and we don't allow a situation to happen where a minority is able to pass legislation that otherwise wouldn't happen.
Yeah. I would respectfully disagree, probably because I always hold the very best up in expectations of what people are going to do. And I don't know why I continue that at this age, but I do. I just get up, dust myself off, and think the next time people are going to do better. But I want you to have a comfort level, as I do all the committee, with what we're doing, that it is well thought out, and that and it's not a huge change, so I'm certainly willing to do that. I would just encourage the committee to think in terms of, as we go forward, let's please keep moving forward, getting this legislation out. Representative Boone, then Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair. And with all due respect to you, Senator George, this, here we go again. The first week we opened this committee, we came in with a package of pre-session filed legislation that we wanted to pass as soon as possible that was unanimously approved on in our interim committee, unanimously, including this bill, this very bill. And we had a lot of discussion, even some of the members who are no longer on the committee, Senator or Representative Krupp and Senator, Senator Cruz, who's no longer on the committee, but unanimously approved of this piece. And it was discussed, and it was discussed about the potential mischievousness, if you will, that people had concerns about. But I never felt it was very seriously a threat, because I'd like to think that everybody who sits on this committee, as well as sits in this body, in this building, is upholding the Constitution, which is, you read it, also in our hearts, that we would be doing the right thing, and that would be protecting the people of this state, doing what needs to be done to address the emergencies, no matter how many of us happen to be still alive and there. And I have a real problem with any of those decisions being partisan in nature. They're strictly, as we heard Dr. Easton talk about, These are life and death situations. I'm sure Director Murphy has experienced some of these things. Other people in the room have. Dr. Goldfinger has experience with things that may happen and how bad they might be. And I can't imagine anybody, I just can't imagine anybody bringing it upon themselves to say, oh, gosh, we've got 12 people here and there, and it's a majority, and I can get this little bill that I've had trouble last three sessions getting through. So I'm going to take the time of the legislature as we're meeting and try to do this. I just think that they would be lambasted in the press, if nothing else, for being self-centered and all that. But I would hope that we could, as a committee, make a decision today on this bill that would do the right thing. I think things are in place here. I think we have, Joan has covered everything in the questions and answers throughout this process. And have a little faith in us, please.
Madam Chair?
I'm going to go to Representative Shoffler and then Senator Johnson.
As much as I love the faith and humanity my lovely co-chairs have, I just don't share it when it comes down to things like this. And a perfect example was Dr. Easton, a rich, wealthy individual from Indiana, was saying yay or nay or whether or not women were going to get contraceptives in this crisis. And they made a moral judgment right then and there, he did or she. So I'm an old hard-leg laborer, but I'm a student of history, and it's replete with examples where people take advantage of chaos. And I have to agree, we have to make sure, and could a majority of this minority of the legislature override a governor's veto in this situation and do what they wanted? I don't know. And where is this money going to come from? I think it should come from a rainy day fund that we're going to establish, I hope, until we can convene a majority of the body of the legislature and really act constitutionally and avoid the very thing that some people think may not happen, but I believe will happen. And I am not ready to move on this at all. This is really important. And we're going to send this to the people to vote on. And if we cannot get this has to be a consensus bill. We have to have 90 legislators and the governor signing off on this, or else it's going to go into the media, it's going to become a political football, and we're all going to be bashing one over the heads over it, and we're going to further divide this community, which is incredibly divided. Are the intentions of the past committee good and positive, and do I share those intentions? Absolutely. But I'm a cynic. And I want to be very careful when we start messing around with this stuff, because I'm not going to go out and do anything rashly. And I hope the people on this committee that were on the further past committee can forgive me, but I'm not in any hurry to move on this today.
Well, Representative Shelton, I think you bring up a very, very good point, and that is if this doesn't give everybody on this committee a comfort level, then it's not going to give everybody at the voting, at the polls, a comfort level. And so I'm very willing to get a comfort level on the committee. Senator Johnson.
Well, regrettably, I am going to have to ally myself with my cynical friend from Happy Valley. I come from the school of thought that says if it's good enough to agree to, it's good enough to write down. And it seems to me that we're very close. I know that this is incredibly annoying to you all that spent the interim working on this suite of bills, but I'm not so sure it's a bad thing to have a second set of eyes look at it, because we are sending it out to the people, and I want it to be a consensus product that we can all stand behind without equivocation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Johnson, and I agree. And so what I would like to do and move on from SGR 6 is to have Senator George work with you, Joan, and come back to us with another improvement to our bill. Representative Shoffler, would you like to join them in working on
the chair, whatever it takes.
Amendment?
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
That would be fine. And one thing we are very close with moving the rainy day fund along is everybody wanting to wait and have it come back to see how that goes through the process. Joan?
Chair, I understand that some people on the committee at least want to say that before the governor can move monies, general fund monies around. The governor has to tap into a rainy day fund. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the concern is, so I'm not sure how to write something that deals with it. And Section 2 of the resolution allows the governor to move general fund monies around only if those monies have already been appropriated. So right now we're in the 2005-2007 biennium. There is an eighth of the biennium left. There's not very much general fund money that has been appropriated and not already spent. Under Section 2, if there were a catastrophic disaster the next time you guys go on an in-district day and you couldn't get back, the only monies the governor would be allowed, general fund monies the governor would be allowed to move around, are those that have been appropriated for this biennium. So the amount of general fund money will depend on where you are in the biennium, but it will always be money that the legislature has appropriated. Section 2 simply allows it to go from the governor to move from one agency to another agency. So if the state library doesn't really need its money in the catastrophic disaster and the health division needs it immediately, the governor could move some appropriation from the state library to the health division, which he's not currently allowed to do under the Constitution. This does not override the part of the Constitution or suspend the part of the Constitution that requires the Legislative Assembly to appropriate money before they can be monies before they can be spent. So, and in paragraph B of section one of subsection one of section two essentially allows the governor to do the same thing with lottery monies. If it's been allocated for one purpose, the governor would be allowed to move the allocation, but not to any purpose that's not already allowed by the Constitution. So again, it's only for lottery, constitutional lottery purposes, just moving something from economic development to, well, from education to economic development or something like that. And that only lasts until the governor gets here, until the legislature gets here and enacts a law saying redirecting general fund or lottery monies. Section 3 of the draft does allow the legislature to override the constitutional purposes of the lottery and allocate monies to what we would consider now non-lottery functions if for purposes of responding to the catastrophic disaster. The rainy day fund that is created in House Bill 2707 will not be appropriated under most circumstances when you have a catastrophic disaster. So in order to require the governor to spend monies from a rainy day fund before moving around monies from the general fund, you would have to override the provision of the Constitution that requires an appropriation before monies may be withdrawn from the Treasury, requires the legislature to appropriate the money. I think this is a legal comment, not a political comment. That seems more radical to me than allowing him to move money that's already been appropriated, general fund money, from one agency to another. So I'm not sure how you would do that. If we had a rainy day fund in the Constitution, other than the Education Stability Fund, which I understand you don't want to use, it would probably be easier. But it's not in the Constitution, and there are currently, in 2707, in the current version of 2707, there are sideboards around when the legislature can appropriate monies from the rainy day fund, how much they can appropriate, a supermajority vote to appropriate, and all that stuff. That if SDR 6 is amended to allow the governor to spend that money first, all that would be overridden. So, and I don't know how else to do it. So I'm probably missing something about the concept, and I just need more explanation.
Representative Krieger.
When you explain it, it becomes complex. To me, it's simple. If it's going to go in the Constitution, the people are going to vote on it. If we state he can do it, he can do it.
Yes.
That's it.
So you want a provision in here that says that if there
back
is
to
a
the same way that you're doing the lottery funds.
Well, but the lottery funds will be monies that have already been allocated by the Legislative Assembly.
Okay.
The rainy day fund.
Unallocated funds that are in the rainy day fund are accessible to the governor under that section when he declares a disaster.
But under the current version of House Bill 2707, monies in the rainy day fund are not available unless the Legislative Assembly appropriates them. And so if the Legislative Assembly adjourns sine die without appropriating any money from the rainy day fund, which, as I understand it, is the intention for most sessions, the monies will not be appropriated.
It doesn't have to be. If it's 2707, it's statutory. The constitutional directive would be over the top of the statute.
But then you want, okay, just so I understand, you want to override the constitutional provision that says no monies may be drawn from the Treasury except in pursuance to an appropriation made by law.
For okay. That purpose only,
Madam Chair.
And do you want, some people consider the Education Stability Fund to be a rainy day fund. You know, you're talking a constitutional revision that could be in effect for another 150 years. So I can't name a fund. Do you want me to describe it in a way that, well, I could specifically exclude the Education Stability Fund because that is in the Constitution, but do you want to put any limits or, and you can't say anything called a rainy day fund, obviously. That's really easy, too easy to. Senator Morissette?
I agree totally with Senator Krieger, or Representative Krieger. We're amending the Constitution. We're overriding anything in the Constitution and any statute.
Right.
So I don't, you know, the thing that I don't want to have happen is that we have something so complex that it ties our hands completely trying to figure out what they can do and what they can't do. I think a simple directive in the Constitution saying this is what the governor can do under these circumstances, and that's it. And then enumerate what the governor can do with which funds, like the rainy day fund or the lottery money or whatever.
I guess what I don't understand is you want to require. I mean, first of all, yes, of course, it's a revision of the Constitution. You can do whatever you want to. Do you want to say that the governor, before the Legislative Assembly gets a chance to come in, the governor can decide on his or her own how to spend money in the rainy day fund, how much to spend, in spite of the fact that the legislature has done nothing with the rainy day fund except create it and put monies into it. You want to give the governor wide open authority to spend the rainy day fund, and in fact require that he do that before he moved general fund appropriations around. I just want to make sure I understand what you're getting at.
I think that should be the case with some time limits on the case and some stipulation that when the
governor... Till we get here.
That the governor may take immediate action to deal with the emergency with funds available until the legislature is here. Now, whatever quorum the legislature will have to get here, I mean, that's a different discussion. But then, as soon as the legislature gets here, then they take over and do the allocations.
Madam Chair. It has to be changed because we have to have a balanced budget, as you know, John. And this
it has to be changed for the rainy day fund because right now the Constitution says nobody gets to spend money that hasn't been appropriated by the legislature. And if I understand correctly, what you're saying is you want it amended to say if there's a catastrophic disaster, the governor may spend any monies in a rainy day fund, whether they've been appropriated or not.
Madam Chair.
I have two other people in the queue. I have Representative Nelson.
Well, I just was going to remind Representative Morissette that we don't have to be here. Okay. Did you see that in the...
Yeah, I understand.
Okay. So, we're still back to the... We don't have to be here. I mean, it's just almost back to Larry's question of are we going to specify how many of us is required to make that vote, and that vote can only be relative to solutions to a catastrophic disaster.
As I understand that what people are talking about now, the legislature wouldn't be involved. I mean, not in the beginning.
Right.
In the beginning, the governor could come in and mm-hmm. spend all the monies in a rainy day fund until the legislature was able to get here and say no.
All right, Senator George, Senator Schaffler, and then Senator Johnson. I mean, Representative Schaffler, and then Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs. Joan, Are you what you're saying is because it's in the Constitution, referencing something that's in statute, you can't really reference the rainy day fund, which is in statute, if it passes this week? Is that what you're saying the problem is?
That's part of the problem.
Because there's nothing to reference, in essence, is what you're...
Right. So you would have to just make a general description of a reserve fund created by law, which would be either by the legislature or, in the future, by the people. That is, you know, I don't know how specific you want to get. That's part of the problem. If, you know, 100 years from now, there might be a rainy day fund for health care. There might be a separate rainy day fund for, you know, lots of different things, like the Education Stability Fund. So I don't think that referring to it is the major problem. I can certainly come up with a way of making a general description of a rainy day fund, although it may be that 50 years from now there will be something else that, if I just thought of the right word, would be a rainy day fund, but doesn't fit the words I thought of. But that's always a problem in drafting.
Okay, I got it. Thank you very much.
Let's see, Representative Shoffler and then Senator Johnson.
Since we are doing the constitutional change, assuming the passage, give the governor, he or she, access to discretionary funds, define discretionary funds, meaning rainy day fund, e-board money, ending fund balance, and have access to those funds until the legislature convenes, which would probably be in a day or two. And then we'd be able to come in here and say yay or nay. But then I have the question again. Does this body have the ability to override the governor's veto on top of it? And it's a small number of people we're talking about. This is a can of worms, and it's vexing for me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you redefine the quorum, the number is insignificant.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
Yes. All right. Thank
you, Madam Chair. I've sort of lost track of what problem we're trying to solve. It seems to me that we have we come back to the question of command and control. Theoretically, in a disaster, we have an Office of Emergency Preparedness that has a command and control structure. I'm trying to figure out if the governor's just willy-nilly in identifying problems and spending money. I'm trying to figure out how somebody spends through a whole rainy day fund. Let's assume there's $1 billion in it in a week. I've lost track of what we're doing. We're moving the emergency management function to the military. I presume in a catastrophic event they're going to have extraordinary expenses, but how much money can you spend in a week?
Well, Senator Johnson, I think I can explain this. I think that there is a discomfort on the committee as to the powers of the governor, and I think that it is reflected in the way that the money is spent, and there is an immediate outgo of funds quickly within the first 24 hours. But it's not going to go through the whole rainy day fund in a week.
No, I know that. I still keep coming back to some, and I'm looking at Ken Murphy sort of hoping maybe he'll raise his eyebrows or something and give me some kind of a signal. But I think that in some of the things that we have heard, there is a problem in command and control. And I don't know whether we're trying to create the governor as having some command and control authority that supersedes what would fall into place in Ken's office in the military department. I'm just trying to understand what's the problem.
Okay, the governor supersedes. And so, Ken, would you like to come up to the table and kind of explain the pecking order here?
Let me refocus my question. In some of the after-action reports that have discussed the failures of response in catastrophic events, it is the absence of clarity about command and control. And I know that the governor is, in effect, the commander-in-chief of the military. But in the command and control structure, does the governor have a functional role, or is it described by the activities that will occur in your shop?
Madam Chair, member of the committee, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm Director of Emergency Management for the state. And the governor is the commander-in-chief, and in the pure sense of the word, could be considered the incident commander. But I'm sure that he will turn to, in this case, if we move to the military, General Reese or myself, which he's done with the Hurricane Katrina experience, and you're in charge. And from that point, then we go ahead and execute what needs to be done along with our other state agencies and partners. I will try and remember back to when the committee first formed as an interim committee that we really started discussing this with Representative Boquist of how to come up with $3 billion in the first 30 days. And then Measure 47, 48, the spending limit was the other thing that was the catalyst to our conversation. And I think as we went through this, it was really reflecting on ourselves as to how to get money, undefined amount of money, in a certain amount of time. And I don't think it's $1 billion in a week, but how to get money to provide relief to the citizens and the visitors of the state of Oregon, and how to do it in such a way that we can do it through the legislative process so that, you know, because we know that we need the legislature here. And I think then we started raising the question, what if they're not available to come to the Capitol, they can't be on a conference call, they can't be video teleconference, or they're a victim, or they're dead? And how do you put together a structure, you know, that we can start making decisions and allocating money out as needed for a disaster? And it clearly doesn't, you know, we keep talking billions. It really doesn't have to be that large an amount. A couple hundred million is a substantial amount of change that we would have to deal with. So command and control. And I take that responsibility, and I know that, you know, I'm not going to wait for the governor to say it. I'm going to take charge and do what we're supposed to do as it relates to the disaster.
Follow up.
And what you're really thinking about is the procuring of potable water, comestibles, those sorts of things that have to be purchased from purveyors somewhere.
Yeah, and usually, Madam Chair and Senator Johnson, that, you know, really that first initial thrust of food, water, shelter, and security, and then closely followed behind medical needs, transportation, but there's that large burst that initially will provide a certain amount of comfort to the victims of a disaster.
Rescue.
All right, we're going to have to move on because Representative Cowan has to leave. And Representative Krieger, excuse me.
Just real quick.
All right.
Madam Chair, Ken, if something was to happen today and you had to spend a bunch of money, and it's authorized under the law, I would assume some way that you can do something, when does the state get the bill? In other words, the catastrophe happens tomorrow, you don't get the bill the next day. Isn't the credit of the state good with most people that they're going to take care of as long as we have money?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Krieger, that's true. I mean, the credit is there, and I think the thing, you know, and additionally to what we're working on, too, I've been working with the Department of Administrative Services to try and pre-plan these contracts, have all this stuff done, and have them accept that and accept the credit of the state because, yeah, and most of them are well aware that, you know, you're not going to get a bill the day after the event. You know, take care of, save lives, protect people, and we'll worry about the billing later.
All right, I'm going to ask Senator George, Representative Schaffler, and Representative Krieger to meet with Joan and go over the amendments on SJR 6. And I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 6. And I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2371. And I'm going to turn the podium over to Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2371 started out as a very important and still quite simple, I think, a bill that would direct some necessary emergency planning within facilities that are aimed primarily at the care of the elderly and children. It came to my attention as we were discussing it, and as a result of the predictable natural disasters that we have in all of our counties, and I certainly have in Lincoln County, that a loss of power for a few days can be really very challenging, particularly to the elderly population if there's no heat, or conversely no air conditioning in areas where heat can be a problem. And so I thought that while we were talking about this emergency planning, we should talk a little bit about planning for that particular situation as well. I had a report of some senior care residential facilities needing to gather around the fireplace, or in one case, literally opening ovens to maintain some heat during a six-day power outage, and that concerns me. Consequently, I recommended drafting of Dash 1 amendments to this bill, and it's come to my attention that the Department of Human Services has some serious concerns with the Dash 1 amendments that you have before you, that the feeling that somehow these mandate that all senior care facilities, including adult foster care, would have to secure generators in order to meet this requirement, and that that would attach significant fiscal impact to this bill. I don't read it that way. My intention was simply to raise the awareness of a fragile elderly population who have little tolerance, physical tolerance, for variations in temperature. That we include that as part of our planning process. We simply just need to address this question and as to how we're going to provide access to ways to alleviate those problems. But concerns being what they are, and with deference to the co-chairs who have a need to pass some of these bills, and because I think they are very important bills too, I'm willing to pull the Dash 1 amendments and to leave that to a further discussion if, Madam Chair, I can get some assurance that in that process of developing rules and moving forward this bill, that that problem that I'm concerned about will be addressed.
We have a number of people that have signed up to testify on the bill, and so I think we can probably work through that. They're in the audience. They've heard what you have to say. And so I'm going to move now and call Sarah Hart.
Right. Madam Chair,
if whomever could address that concern could do it in the early part of the testimony, I'd very much appreciate it, because right. I am on a time problem. I have a time problem today.
Right. Sarah wants to bring someone up with it. Jenny O'Malley.
Dan Higginson is trying to get your attention.
Okay.
Ooh.
Dr. Higginson.
Co-Chair Verger, Co-Chair Boone, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the administrator for the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, State Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I have been in front of this committee before on House Bill 2371 to express the department's support of this bill. We continue to support this bill. There have been issues raised about possible redundancy or possible new reporting requirements, and we think all of that can be taken care of in rule. We've also taken a look at both the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments. We have no problem with the Dash 2 amendments. On the Dash 1 amendments, and I have talked to Representative Cowan about this, conceptually, we're absolutely in agreement. If people are out of heat in a facility that we have a licensing responsibility for, those people should not sit around a stove. If people are out of water for 3 days, they should not be relying on cleansing soap for their hands. I mean, those issues need to be dealt with, and we intend to deal with those. We think that the appropriate place to deal with those are in rural. And the only concern of ours is that some of the language in this amendment, we believe, ties us to making sure that there are actually things happening at the facilities themselves, rather than making sure that there are plans to address getting them to some place that is safe and healthy.
Okay, so you are comfortable with the bill passing with the dash twos, and you would take care of it in rural?
We would take, Co-Chair Berger, yes, we would take care of the issues that Representative Cowan has addressed and agree with. We would take care of that in rural. And I know in working with Representative Cowan for a number of years that she will make sure that we do what she wants to have happen.
Do you want to respond to that before we move on, Representative Cowan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted it on the record. I do have confidence that the department will work with me.
All right.
And so whatever process needs to take place to withdraw that, you have my approval. And with that, I would sincerely hope that you're able to move this bill today.
All right. Thank you. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Dr. Higginson, explain to me what you think the dash twos mean.
And Co-Chair and Berger and Senator Johnson, if I could I pass the mic to Tina Kitchen?
She's got the gavel.
Yes, you certainly may.
Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Tina Kitchen. I'm the medical director for the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. And so we are actually the agency that does the licensing for seniors and the other vulnerable population, not the healthcare facilities. And as Representative Cowan is leaving, I'd like to reassure her that we also are highly in support of making sure that seniors in facilities and homes that we license have adequate heat and, if necessary, adequate cooling. And we would love to work with her on some of those rules. To answer your question, Senator Johnson, co-chairs Verger and Byrne, the problem is with us writing rules to ensure, not to address, to ensure continued access to heat and air conditioning. And right now our rules do not, under circumstances where the power's been out for 24 hours, right now we do not ensure, especially in adult foster homes, access to air conditioning. In that it's not a necessary service in most parts of the state. So it would appear for these single family homes that we, especially when they have the wind structures where transportation goes down because of the trees across the rural roads, et cetera, that we could not ensure access to this without actually providing generators and the prices.
Madam Chair, that's the dash one.
That's the dash one.
I'm sorry, dash one. Dash two we support.
Tell me what you think the dash twos do.
I'm sorry. I'm not quite sure exactly what the dash twos
that's my
intended
problem
to do. I think if it does anything, it expands to any other not currently known agency or board or commission that may license or have responsibility over these homes. I'm not quite sure who those agencies would be.
Madam Chair, I would submit if the department doesn't know what the dash twos mean, that I'm going to have a lot more trouble than they are understanding the dash twos. And under those circumstances, I've got a real hard time supporting them.
It just looks to me like, for whatever reason, the dash twos were put in to expand that responsibility. And so I don't know that there's I don't know that there's anything to mean by it. Now, why it's there is another question.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I just can't vote for an amendment that the agency that's charged with implementing it
doesn't know what it does. That's a threshold I can't get over.
Uh-huh. Okay. Dr. Higginson?
Co-chair Verger, and I don't know, and Senator Johnson, I do not know where these amendments came from. My understanding from reading them is similar to Dr. Kitchen's, that this was simply expanding the number of other departments, agencies, and commissions who were included in the same rules that you are now asking the department to promulgate regarding these facilities.
This was an amendment put in by Senator Gary George. All right. Anything else?
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes.
Since nobody can agree on what they mean, and we have assurance from the department that they will do what Representative Cohen was concerned with, why don't we just pass the bill out as is, not amended?
Yeah. I have a couple more people that would like to make presentations. Tina?
No.
Sarah, would you like to come now?
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My name is Sarah Tarr. My expertise is in curriculum management, curriculum development, program evaluations. And one of the things that I want to really bring to your attention here, and the reason I take such umbrage in making something that is going to affect such a fragile population as the seniors and these people in these homes, is that there's no consistency in standards. There's no consistency in application. I think that the presentation by Dr. Easton was very well timed for this, because there's not a sense of, well, always do it this way. When you teach someone to do something, you need to make it such that you always have muscle memory in how to do things. When you say that these people should have an emergency plan and they don't know what to do, then that means they're not trained well. That means that there's not an application that is across the board that everybody will understand. And so when I read this rule, I'm a little bit concerned that there's not an understanding of how to deal with transportation for these people. I mean, if they're going to have to leave for whatever reason, that's not addressed here, and it's not in any of the documents that were used in analyzing this bill. One of the documents used in analyzing this bill was policies, practices, and procedures made by the Oregon State Fire Marshal Office. And it's very comprehensive, but even in here, there's nothing to do with how do you deal with some documents? How do you deal with transportation? How do you deal with emergency supplies? There's nothing anywhere written in any of these kinds of documents that will help agencies such as these kinds of homes, how to prepare for any kind of emergency. And I just know that Chairman Boone and Verger really want things to run well, and so do I. And I want to make sure that you think about these things before you pass a bill that is really not very implementable, or there's no standard on which we can say this is good. In fact, we should use this as our model for every other kind of emergency preparedness bill. It's not here yet, as far as I can see.
I'm going to respond, and then I'll ask my co-chair to respond. I believe that you're thinking in terms of our dealing in it in a local level and in each facility or with the Department of Human Services. Our legislation is looking at it at a higher level and not to necessarily mandate. I think that's one of the problems that we had with the First Amendment, that it was getting very specific. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're responsible for a vulnerable population and you have a nursing home or a child care. What we are saying is you have to have an emergency evacuation plan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're not going to tell you A, B, C, but we're saying you have to have a plan, and it must be practiced. So I would you like to respond, Madam
That's
Teacher?
That's exactly what I would have said, too. We're not writing the plan. All of these agencies, these services are regulated by state agencies, and we don't want to be micromanaging in that area. We just want to, this is the plan, the idea was to have, they have a plan and they practice it. So when something happens, they know what to do.
Madam Chair.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. I think we want to make sure everybody has a plan so they aren't caught flat-footed. And I think what we'll find out is that most people do have a plan. That's what I think we're going to find out here. And we're just kind of catching up statutorily with and by rule with what these services and these homes and centers are already doing. Clearly, the Oregon City example jumps into my brain where they yarded out all them folks when the place caught on fire. And they had a plan and it worked, and fortunately it wasn't snowing out. But I think that's what we're going to find, and it's just make a fail the plan, and a plan to fail, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I think we'll find most people already are. So that's just my two drinks. And I think if we move it out unamended, and I think we'll be fine, my humble opinion.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2371, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2371.
Madam Chair.
And I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2371 to the House floor with a recommendation, a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Nelson moves House Bill 2371 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Johnson.
I'm sorry. This is like stomping bunnies to keep asking questions about this bill. At this point, do we have a definition for child care facilities?
Senator Johnson, are you sure you're not stomping bunnies?
I'll get it for you.
I would suppose that we would have a definition for child care facilities.
Should be in statute, according to this.
Are you thinking in terms of care, various kinds
someone
might fall through the crack?
I'm just thinking about the cost in the cases where it's already appears to be required. Adult foster care are required to have emergency plans. I think what this bill is adding is the ability to practice them. We've talked about this bill again so long that I've just gotten sort of lost in what we're trying to do. It seems as though some of these already have requirements, and if the direction of the bill is to practice the drills, then I don't know if we've heard from industry about how expensive it is or what people would be involved or what standard. What if you can't get them out in 3 minutes? Or what if it takes four?
This was Representative McPherson's bill. And he, even though he felt that there were a number of them that had evacuation routes, and even though they may practice, he wanted to be sure. I think it was from the episode in Katrina,
okay,
that with the elderly that were left there to die. And so I think...
Okay, well, I have already opined on the failure of character in Katrina that no rules can overcome.
Everything that could go wrong would go wrong, and I don't know that our laws are going to modify behavior.
Okay, I'll stop asking questions about the bill.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry that wouldn't you believe that the volume containing the statute that Senator Johnson wants with the meaning of a child care facility, it happens to not be here, but it is on line 26 in the bill.
It's
first
in the
page.
ORS.
In the ORS.
Okay.
657A, part 258.
It, yeah, it's in the last page of the bill. All right. Any objections? If not, so ordered. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 29.24.
Judith? Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2924 appropriates monies from the general fund to the State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries for the Oregon Territorial Seafloor Mapping Project at Oregon State University. It would declare an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. We have received no revenue impact. We're still waiting for the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. I'll call Director Soliday.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. The department is neutral on the bill, but I wanted to come and talk a little bit about how we might use this information should this project get funded. The land board did hear a presentation from the folks at OSU about this project, and I think we're pretty enthusiastic about the potential to actually have this information available to them as they're making decisions on the various potential uses of the territorial sea. And I think, as everybody knows, the Department of State Lands manages the submerged and submersible lands in the state of Oregon, including the territorial sea. And so we have some particular uses of this information that are unique to the Department of State Lands. We have a number of fiber optic cables that come across the territorial sea to provide high-speed internet service and communication services, not just in the United States but around the world. In fact, we have two new cables that are probably going to come this summer to increase capacity for the Olympics in China in 2008. So one of the ways that we might use this data is to help us cite other, to identify other potential landings across the territorial sea for fiber optic cables. Also, as the development of wave energy moves forward in the territorial sea, this data may give us some good information about the more appropriate places to site those wave energy facilities out in the territorial sea than in the absence of this data. And I think there's also some other uses of this data. The Ocean Policy Advisory Council and others are taking a look at various management tools that could be used in the territorial sea in order to sustain the various resources that are available in the marine environment. And I think having this data will help to inform that discussion as it moves forward over the next couple of years. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Director Soliday, let me ask you something. Will this help put up any sideboards for wave energy projects along in the territorial sea? I am disturbed. There are six applications to FERC, all for wave energy projects, many of them getting very organized and moving ahead. We have several bills in the legislature. Is there some way that this will help us at all control what happens on the Oregon coast?
Madam Co-Chair, I don't know that it will help us control. I think it'll give us information that we can use as the department and the land board are making decisions about which of those energy projects it wants to authorize in the territorial sea. And it may be useful in the FERC process, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission process, as they make decisions about authorizing, issuing final licenses to wave energy companies to generate commercial energy out in the ocean. But I don't think this bill, it's in and of itself, puts any controls. It's simply providing funding to provide a set of information that we currently don't have available to us, and that is what our seafloor actually looks like.
Well, I guess that I was thinking in terms of using that information about the seafloor. I think I may be, it might be a stretch. I think maybe I'm looking for some kind of guidelines here,
well,
because I do have some concerns. So.
Well, Madam Co-Chair, as I said, I do think the information will be useful to the land board as it's looking at applications that come in front of it for various wave energy authorizations in terms of making those determinations. Now, the question is whether this information is going to be available in time for the initial decisions that we're going to be making on those wave energy proposals.
All right. Thank you. In the essence of time, I'm going to call now Dr. Vicki McConnell and Dr. Chris Goldfinger from OSU to talk about the tsunami model.
Madam Chair, as they're coming up, have you filled in the blank on the fiscal?
We don't have it yet, but it's under $6 million.
This is LIDAR?
No.
Oh, this is not LIDAR?
No.
Okay.
They'll line you out on this right now.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries.
And Madam Co-Chairs and members of the committee, I'm Chris Goldfinger, Professor of Oceanography at Oregon State University.
Co-Chairs and committee members, first speaking as the director and representing the Department of Geology, although we remain neutral on this particular bill, I do want you to know that we certainly support the incredibly important data collection and compilation of such a tool as bathymetry or seafloor mapping, if you want to call it that. And to address Senator Johnson's comment about is this LIDAR or not, this is the seafloor analogy to the LIDAR. LIDAR is used as a particular tool that's used for collecting very accurate elevation data on the ground, on the terra. And this is a tool, bathymetry, that does the same thing with seafloor mapping. So, and what we look at are the fact that we'd like to look at this as relatively seamless data collecting from the territorial sea through the near shore to the coast and along into the continental part of the state where you have, and in my case I'm talking about primarily looking at geological hazards that you would use these kind of tools for when you're doing such things as tsunami inundation mapping, determining where earthquake fault scarps or active earthquakes are, looking at, and I'm not going to rain on your parade here. And the other thing would be very important is looking at sea level rise and coastal erosion. Now, what we're looking at is the tool and the seamless merging of both those technologies and those tools.
All right. Senator Johnson.
Just a quick question. It looks like on the sheet that you handed out, it says investment of $2.5 million general fund over two biennia.
Co-chairs and Senator Johnson, if you direct you to that, that is, it says current Dogami issues that would benefit from bathymetric data. And we do have an issue now of trying to accelerate our tsunami inundation mapping for the entire coast. And that needs the LIDAR and the bathymetric data to be able to accelerate that particular program. And what we had, that is simply a physical for that program. It doesn't refer to the cost for the bathymetry.
Dr. McConnell, maybe you should distinguish between each one of the things, the inundation, the LIDAR, and then the model.
Oh, certainly, Co-Chair Verger and Co-Chair Boone and Senator Johnson. In an inundation acceleration, in accelerating that mapping program, you really need three things. You need the base tools, which are the bathymetry and the LIDAR, to be able to have your basic background data. You then develop inundation models based on that and other mapping tools. And then at that, from those inundation models, you develop your final inundation maps of the areas. So those are really three parts. And that's only for what we would use the bathymetry for. I believe when you were speaking with Director Soliday, she was talking about a whole other aspects of what you would be using bathymetry for as well.
All right.
Madam Co-Chair, as members of the committee, I have to apologize. I managed to dash out of my office and leave the printed material sitting on my desk right where I couldn't possibly forget it. So I'll get that to you. And
some of us do things like that, too, so don't worry.
I'm happy to hear that. Director Soliday and Dr. McConnell did a nice job of listing some of the uses of the bathymetry data and distinguishing the bathymetry from the LIDAR, which are completely different tools. One's collected with a ship, and the LIDAR is collected with an airplane. The seafloor mapping has a number of uses. In addition to that, we talked about tsunami modeling, and that's obviously a key thing. And I can just elaborate a little bit on that. There are several key links in the chain in order to get from an understanding of tsunamis to getting to lines on the ground where you can tell people that are, you know, with some confidence that they're, these are inundation lines that can be expected to be somewhat real. And the first and most important is the geology of the earthquake that launches the tsunami in the first place. And the bathymetry comes in shortly thereafter, after the wave travels away from the earthquake and toward the shore, and becomes incorporated in the hydrodynamic model of what happens to the wave. And then the topography determines what happens to the wave when it gets up onto land where it's not supposed to be in the first place. And so you really need all three of those things in place to be able to say something about what a tsunami will do. And so bathymetry data is not a magic bullet. It's not going to solve all three of those, but it's critical to a critical link in the chain to get from one to the other. There were a few other things that previous presentations didn't mention that this data will be useful for. One of them is things like point source pollution tracking. When you have something like an oil spill, a tanker crash, or something like that, if you try to run a model showing what the tides and currents will do, you need to know the bathymetry to have an understanding of that. So that's one of the things that wasn't mentioned previously, but I think most of the main uses for it have been well covered.
Questions? Representative Shelford.
Sure. For the reasons that the good professor just spelled out, I think it's a good idea to do it, and I want to do it. My question, though, is procedural. With a $6 million price tag, and I understand it's not in the governor's recommended budget, does this bill have a referral to Ways and Means? Okay. Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Nelson.
I hate to even ask a question because I really, I just love to use these words, and I don't even know what any of them are. But LIDAR and bathymetry and geomorphology, I'm just loving it. I don't know anything about any of this, but it sounds good and right, and I know we need to get prepared. But could you just tell me, without my causing a big problem, what do you're not... was it designating building codes for the coast have to do with this activity? I don't know. I received some correspondence like that, and I'm just curious. You know, it was basically that there was a lack of support from Dadami for, you know, let's do something about this, but let's also do something about the building code. So I'm just wondering, is this anywhere related?
Chair Verger and Boone and Representative Nelson, I believe what you're referring to is a criticism of the agency for not discussing or going to standing firmer with USGS when they developed their probabilistic maps on what the actual hazard would be for the coastline of Oregon. And I have to respectfully disagree with the gentleman that I believe wrote that letter, that we have worked very hard with the U.S. Geological Survey in developing the and what we mean by probabilistic maps is you incorporate a wealth of information from a wealth of different sources of professors and researchers on what the probability of the Cascadia subduction zone earthquake occurring. And from that, a map of risk probable risk is developed then. And some people feel that the whole coast, the entire coast, should be in a much higher zone. And the science doesn't quite, the complete science doesn't completely benefit from that. And so I agree. I would like to put, I actually think that we should have be a higher earthquake zones, maybe all the way into the Cascade Range. But I can't, that's a personal opinion, and I don't have the science to back that up. So we do stand behind what Building Codes has adopted based on the science that they base that on.
Thank you very much.
I just wanted to, this came out a long time ago to all of us when we first heard the seafloor mapping presentation from Dr. Don Wright and Dr. Goldfinger back in the interim committee. And one of the, I guess, the most compelling thing is without a coordinated effort and without some funding now, they're going to limp along at $200,000-$300,000 a pop, and we have 5% of the floor mapped now. It'll take about 50 years to complete it. And we really don't have that kind of time. And the first, in my opinion, this is a great project in any case, but it's really compelling to me to get this done now. And the main purpose would be for adequate and an honest and credible tsunami modeling. And with Dogami's already got their money, they're starting to get more lined up for their LIDAR mapping to do the coast. We could do this. We could get a good model going. And they also, as an additional benefit, they use out-of-work fishermen to do the work.
Oh.
So it's kind of an extra
win-win.
Yeah, it is. And I think they're limited to weather and time of year and things like that. So the longer we wait, the longer it's going to take. Yes, there are several subsequent benefits also to research needs, other things, fisheries research, et cetera. But I think the reason to do it quickly would be the tsunami modeling. We have heard all kinds of guesstimates of what's going to happen if the big one hits and at different levels of it, and you're the experts there. We don't have to go over. He totally depressed me the first time I heard him. Yeah, I still like you, though. But the point is that they can only do so much without this knowledge. And once they get the knowledge, then they can give us an adequate and a scientific model of what's going to happen when the wave hits, so you'll know what to do about building and schools, hospitals, people who are talking about building or replacing existing public structures need this kind of information in order to make a good guess and a good guess. I'm losing it here. We need it to get this work finished, to get this our emergency preparedness plans in place so that we even Ken will know where to tell the locals to set up, you know, so they're not in the water, basically.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
If that was a motion, a couple of us have a committee that starts at 5. If that was a motion.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2924, and I'm going to open a work session, and Representative Brown.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2924 to the with a referral to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boone moves House Bill 2924 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam,
yes,
Madam Chair. I
Marcet.
May have been out of the room when you mentioned the amount in this.
We're still waiting for a solid.
Ballpark.
It's under $6 million. It's under $6 million to
over
do the entire
biennium.
Yes,
okay.
Over the biennium.
Okay.
Yes, and I have been in discussion with members of Ways and Means. I have a meeting tomorrow, as a matter of fact, with several people on this. And we'll.
Yes.
Thank you.
Are there any objections? If not, so moved. House Bill 2670 will be carried over until the meeting on March 15th. Representative Cowan will carry the first bill. All right. If no other business to come before the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.